If you want to be at the tip of the spear of sports performance, the answer is simple. Simply Faster is your insider's edge to maximize results with the highest quality premier sports equipment in the business. Visit Simply Faster and level up. Welcome everyone to the Companions of the Compendium podcast. Today, I've got my man in strength and conditioning, Keith Ferrara. Today, we are going to be talking about all things strength and conditioning, developing a program, starting from scratch, things that make us happy, things that make us pissed, and everything in between. From one Italian brother to another, I'm super excited to have this guy on my podcast. There's a lot of value. He's got a very large network because of all the stuff that he puts out there and the respect that he has amongst his peers. So Keith, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. I love to be able to talk to people in all these different avenues. And, you know, I'm kind of a niche track and field guy, but I feel like the sport that connects, you know, the strength and conditioning guys fit really, really well with the sport of track and field, just because we're constantly trying to push performance up.
Yeah, 100% agree. It's so funny. During this time, you know, COVID, unique time, but I felt like I've expanded my knowledge so much further because of the track and field community, and they've opened my eyes to so many new things. It's refreshing to be able to pick some different minds and explore a lot of different training methods, which has, you know, benefited me and our athletic program.
Absolutely, man. And so getting into that, let's talk a little bit about your development, what brought you into the world of strength and conditioning, who were your mentors that kind of brought you to this point where you're at today?
Yeah. So I would say my love for, you know, working out started when I was a freshman in high school. I played football. I started at the age of 13. I always played sports my entire life, but obviously, you know, training was never really an emphasis at that point. So at 13, when I started playing football, you know, I just decided I got to start working out. So, you know, no structure, mostly body part training, you know, none of what you would normally see from a good structure program nowadays, but that's where my love for, you know, first started for it, because I saw how much it impacted my body and playing. So I was lucky enough to receive a lot of scholarship offers at high school. I wound up playing at Hofstra University from 2007 to 2009. And I would say my love for the profession and my respect for what it did for me and my teammates grew tremendously at Hofstra. So then in 2009, I wound up cutting the program, which was pretty shocking to all of us. The program had been running since 1937, multiple NFL alumni, Super Bowl champions. So for the program to be shut down out of nowhere was pretty devastating. But I was getting ready to move on. You know, I had a couple of scholarship offers lined up to get out of there. And, you know, I wound up suffering a pretty bad injury in training. It's what it's called, compartment syndrome. And it went undiagnosed by many different doctors, and I wound up finding the right doctor who at the time thought, you know, hey, yeah, we might have to amputate your leg. It's pretty bad. So, jeez. You know, yeah, it was crazy, you know, for a 19, 20 year old to, you know, going through, hey, they just cut your football program. Now you're pretty much on the table, and it was a situation of life and death looking back. Compartment syndrome, it has killed people before. So, you know, I spent 17 days in the hospital. I lost about, I don't know, 35, 40 pounds. You know, my parents, you know, they said to the doctor, you know, when can he play football again? And the doctor was pretty straight up and saying, listen, he's probably never going to walk again. So prepare for that life. So that was all pretty devastating to hear. You know, I had a couple severed nerves, so I had no function in my foot. And, you know, I remember this to this day. I was at the neurologist, you know, I'm about to receive pretty bad news that I've lost complete function of my foot. And I saw a sign that said life is 10% what happens to you, 90% what you make of it. And, you know, after I left that doctor, I was pretty devastated because, you know, they let me know where I was at. But I decided from that point on, I wasn't going to let this control my life. And that's where sports performance and strength and conditioning became my life. It wasn't, hey, this is what I do for fun. It's how am I going to get back to the life I want? And I was able to, you know, really make a strong recovery. You know, I was in better shape than I ever was in my entire playing career. And I decided from that point on, I wanted to help athletes accomplish their goals that I was no longer going to be able to achieve because of my injury. So this is more than just a job. And I've said this to multiple people over the years, this is my life, and to help people accomplish what they want. That's my goal in my life and being in this profession.
That's wild, man. In terms of the foot today, where are you at all these many years later?
Yeah, normal. You know, you would, besides a massive scar on my lower left leg, you wouldn't think there's anything wrong with me, you know. And I really believe the brain is so powerful, and I think it carries over to training so greatly. It really does matter how strong you are mentally and how you can perform physically. So if you saw me today, you would think there's nothing wrong. And I don't even think about the injury. I barely even think of it on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's incredible, man. I had anything that serious, but when I was, you know, in high school, I came down with Crohn's disease, which can be serious for some people, where you have to take out intestines and maybe have a colostomy bag and all sorts of different types of things and take lots of steroids and different medicines. And my parents just dove in deep to all the different type of preventative measures and holistic measures and good doctors as well. Thankfully, most of the time it's in remission and it doesn't cause me any problems, unless I'm on a, you know, family trip and I'm stuck in a place and I'm super stressed out and I'm eating irregular food and drinking irregular drinks and all this kind of stuff. But I remember, like, it was so different for me because the doctors never told me those things. I mean, I'm sure they told my parents, like, all the serious repercussions, and my mom had colitis and things like that. So, you know, my grandmother had a colostomy bag and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, then when I met with one of my relatives up in, you know, the Indiana, Northern Indiana, they call it the region area. And these guys are blunt speaking Italians, you know, and they're like, we thought you had one foot in the grave, you know, and I'm like, Jesus, you know, and I look at my mom and she's like, yeah, it was pretty serious, Ryan. And I'm like, why didn't anybody tell me this, you know, and I'm a little kid, you know, and they didn't want to put that on me. And then later on, not too far after that, probably related, I severely tore my hamstring, you know, all the way through, and it never healed quite right. And I had to have surgery on that, but certainly no amputation or death or anything like that I was aware of, you know. And it's one of those things, though, where you're faced with that. And it's really interesting. And it speaks to this point that you just mentioned, this whole idea of the 90% of how you react to it. There's a lot to be said for, like, the greatest human beings. I think it was Encyclopedia Britannica profiled all these different biographies of very successful people. And the one thing that almost, it was 85% of them had in common, was that they were given a very difficult life challenge, life or death type of experience, something devastating that happened to them, where many people who aren't the type of person that you are with the attitude that you have just go, well, I guess that's what it is. And, oh, well, I can't move the needle for myself, so I might as well just give up, versus what you did and said, I'm going to do everything I can to get back and prepare and do all this. And since I gave myself this gift and this path, I'm going to help provide that space and that path for everybody else. And that's truly where you find greatness, is through that struggle.
Yeah. And it's really mentality. And I see it everywhere. And I'm not just talking about athletics. I just think in life, you know, people who are negative, who think the worst of everything, they usually have more challenging lives, you know, as opposed to people who go through the worst and you see them have a smile on their face every day and they know they're going to be successful no matter what they do. You know, those are the people that are going to win their entire lives, because they just have a different mindset and approach to each and every day. And I think that goes a far way. That goes way beyond athletics, but it's so important to have a positive mindset, because when you do deal with adversity, it's almost just like a challenge. And that's how I saw it. I'm like, they're not going to define me, you know? And as long as you have that mindset, I think you'll always win in life.
Absolutely, man. So when you're talking about your path and kind of going down this road and through self-discovery and learning some of those things and things that you did to get yourself prepared, who were other people that kind of kept popping up in your story that either were mentors then or are mentors now that have led you to kind of develop further of your system and your philosophy?
Yeah, you know, for me, well, all of my coaches, I have to give credit. And obviously the training has gotten significantly better over the years. But, you know, my coaches throughout the years pushed me to be a better athlete, pushed me to be a better person each and every day. And I'm forever indebted to everything they did from high school through college. And then all my colleagues in the field, obviously they were a tremendous support in me getting, you know, finally my position at Adelphi. But, you know, the biggest book that was a game changer for me in changing my mindset and taking me to where I am was definitely Triphasic Training by Cal Dietz. And whether or not you particularly want to follow that type of system, that's totally up to you as a coach. As a professional, we have to make changes based on what we think is fitting. Where that book differentiated my mindset was, well, how do we train people to be better at their sport? Not just how do we get them stronger, not just how do we, you know, make them more powerful. How do we train qualities that are going to transfer over to the things that matter? And ever since reading that, I've been down this journey for the past 7 years of how do I build better athletes? And I really have to give credit that triphasic training book, not only in the methods, but in just the rationale of training the nervous system versus body parts, has been such a game changer in my program. I always tell Cal, you know, whenever I have the opportunity to talk with him, like, thank you, because the amount of information you share has completely impacted how I've developed as a coach.
Yeah, certainly he's a person that a lot of people lean on for a lot of cutting edge ideas, but also practicality. And he describes it in a way that's really pretty easy for those to consume. So for the audience though, that hasn't picked up that book, what was like the big thing that was the aha moment within that book that really kind of developed the sense that you have now?
Yeah, definitely the thinking of the nervous system versus the muscular system, and how the nervous system at the end of the day is controlling every single movement that we do. And, you know, when we're in a constant state of, you know, fight or flight, the amount of damage that actually does to our body, as opposed to the parasympathetic, which is going to calm it down. I think that general overall, thinking of how the nervous system impacts us on a daily basis. And then besides that, it's just the muscle action and how we train it. You know, my entire career, we just put a huge emphasis on one of the three muscle actions. So, you know, there's the eccentric, the isometric, and the concentric. Most people just trained the concentric because they felt like that was the only thing that mattered. But how you load, the transition from that load to the explosive portion of all exercises, we do it for every movement in our lives. And to not train those two qualities, the eccentric and the isometric, you're limiting the concentric and you're missing developing the total system. So I would say that nervous system development and training all muscle actions, those were the two big keys that I think every coach should be cognizant of with their training.
Awesome. And you're totally right. Like, there are moments of all of those things happening in almost everything we do. If you get out of the bed without assistance, you're doing all three of those things.
Right.
And it's so funny because we do spend so much time working on that concentric action all the time. And it's like, that's great, but you got to make sure that you're doing all of these other things, or you're going to have not only an imbalance of, you know, maybe posture or musculature or anything like that, but just like you said, movements and how we're firing. So taking that into a different direction, how would you lay out the eccentric, isometric, and concentric in a routine? Give us an example of how you actually put that into real world in a training session with a lift or with a combination of workouts.
Yeah, so I'm big on training one quality at a time in the weight room. First off, before I even get into the strength block, we will just do a work capacity block, some type of GPP work, where we're just working on building the base. We're teaching our nervous system the correct firing patterns, and we're just setting the foundation for a higher ceiling when it comes to strength work. So after we put an emphasis on that, probably for a 4-week block, but it really depends if we're, you know, I get teams back in August and we're playing 2 weeks later. So the GPP block will probably be around 2 weeks. And then we'll kind of structure it where we'll do 2 weeks where we emphasize the eccentric portion and the isometric portion. Now, within that week of a 3-day split, our eccentric and isometric work will be on the first and third day. And then that middle day will be a concentric focused lift. So on that day, maybe, you know, if we're doing, you know, an eccentric squat on day one, on day two, maybe we're doing just a concentric deadlift. And then on day three, maybe we're doing, you know, an eccentric front squat or eccentric split squat, whatever that may look like. So we do that for 2 weeks, then we'll go to isometric for 2 weeks, and then we'll finish with a concentric block for 2 weeks. And then from there, like I said, now you've set the foundation for developing power, developing speed with regards to the weight room. And now you can kind of focus on whatever the weaknesses are of the athlete or whatever part of the season you're in. But in general, I like to just focus on training the strength quality by itself before I transition into anything else.
Very cool. And do you circle back to that throughout the season? Do you ever circle back to the GPP and then the 2 week blocks for the eccentric, isometric, and concentric after you get out of a competitive phase? Do you, how does that rotation go?
Yeah. So we're always going to work. We're always going to re-hit that strength, right? The residual for strength is, you know, it could be anywhere from 25 to 35 days. So we want to make sure that we're retraining that. I think that's where a lot of the technology comes into play with regards to the weight room. And, you know, with velocity-based trainings, we can track strength as the season goes on. So, but for me, you know, my veteran athletes, they'll come back, we'll hit our, and veterans, juniors and seniors, I think in general, that's who I'm referencing here. You know, we'll hit strength before the in season, low volume. And then as the season goes on, I start to individualize the programming based on their needs. And then after the off season, we will hit another GPP or their, you know, their postseason, you know, they finish their postseason, they have 2 weeks off, then they're back with me. We'll do another GPP block, and then we'll do 2 weeks each of eccentric and isometric. And then again, we'll start to focus on their specific weaknesses, because usually at that time of development, they're strong enough. And I say strong enough where it's no longer going to take a huge carryover to speed development, because that's the most important quality that I'm thinking about. Like, are we getting faster? Are we jumping higher? Are we more powerful? Actual qualities that matter when you're talking about sport development. To me, it's, you have to readdress that, because I think we all start to lose that strength as time goes on. So you re-hit that quality, and then you start to focus on the weaknesses that they specifically need to become better athletes.
Yeah, I love that, hearing that, because a lot of times my big frustration, and this is not an indictment of strength and conditioning in general, I think it's you know, just you go through series of evolutions through sport, through preparation for sport, all sorts of different stuff. And so when I look at the S and C, I always feel like a lot of the S is being dealt with all the time, but the C seems to be like a mystery,
right?
You know, and it, or it's a little C, you know, like, yeah. I say sometimes I'm a Catholic with a little C, right. You know, so I'm still, you know, going on Easter and Christmas and praying, but maybe I'm not going to the priest, the padre, and asking for Hail Marys,
right.
You know, but anyway, I love hearing that, because we need to convert that strength to something. It's nice to be strong, but it's much nicer to be powerful, you know? And I think that that's a philosophy that you definitely live by based on your influences and people who you've mentioned. Would you agree?
100%. Yeah. I think that what has happened, and I say what has happened because I went through it myself, where my main focus was, what does our 1RM look like? And I fell into the trap of thinking that that continues to matter for 4 years. Like I said, it's challenging because there's a lot of data out there, but the population is different with that data. So even if there's a study out there like, hey, you know, and I know Matt Rea, he has that number of 1.7 times your body weight. And then anything above that, I've heard different people say 2 times, 2.2 times your body weight in the squat. That's great. Those are great numbers. They might not be applicable to the athletes you're working with. So what you have to kind of figure out is, well, running through a strength block, are my athletes continuing to get faster and are they and more powerful with that? Now, if that's happening through just basic strength work, I would continue that. But what you have to kind of assess is, okay, you know, we're doing strength work, let's say for 12 weeks. Let's say you're a coach and all you care about is the 1RM. And then you start to notice, all right, you know, we're measuring sprints. They're really not getting any faster. Okay, red flag. That's a huge red flag. All right, you know, hey, their vert was continuing to go up throughout the year, and now we kind of hit a dead point. We're actually decreasing a little bit. Another red flag. So to me, you always have to link your training to athletic qualities that matter in sport. Speed will always matter. Power will always matter. You have to constantly assess, are those areas that are progressing, are we maintaining, or are we decreasing? Because then you have to seriously reevaluate what you're doing in the weight room.
Absolutely. So speaking of that, what's a battery of tests that you commonly use to figure out where we are? Are we maintaining, progressing, or digressing? So, or having some sort of atrophy? What are you doing to kind of target that in and deal with that?
Yeah. So for my testing, you know, we do a bunch of different things. Like I said, obviously we have the velocity based training that we use in the weight room. So we kind of see if there's any, you know, disruption in our strength development. Are they not firing on all cylinders today? Do we have to scale back the volume? So that's the thing, you know, we're doing in the weight room on a daily basis. Now, when it comes to the sprinting aspect, you know, we're fortunate enough. We have Swift and we have the Muscle Lab Laser. So we're able to constantly measure sprints in an efficient way. So, you know, we'll look at their peak velocity. We'll look at their acceleration. We'll be able to look at their peak power and peak force. So to me, and I don't look at it on a daily basis, like, are we PRing today? Because I think that's a crazy thing to kind of look at. No one's going to PR every day. And if you actually have that mindset, I need to PR today, and you don't, then what does that do to the mentality of the athlete? That's not what we're looking for. We're looking for, can you maximize what you have for the day? And so that's one of the sprinting tests we'll look at. And, you know, we do different variations of sprints. You know, like I said, maybe we're looking at, you know, their fly sprint for the day, but maybe we're just looking for, maybe a 30-meter sprint, anything like that, and we're able to see the splits. And then for jumping, you know, I love the Scandinavian rebound jump test. Basically, for people that don't know, it's just five repeated jumps, hands on your hips, or you can go with your hands involved, and you're just looking at people's reactive strength index, their jumping, their power output, and you're recognizing, all right, are we trending in the right direction for qualities that actually matter?
Are you using a jump mat for that, for the Scandinavian test?
Yeah, so we have the Muscle Lab contact grid. One of the best investments I've ever made, hands down. Easy to use. You get a ton of data. Like I said, from that one test, I'm able to see power output, RSI, stiffness, with regards to the athlete and their body weight, which to me is one area that is kind of underrated that people don't look at. Body weight matters. So, you know, if you're a bigger person and you're producing, and let's say you gain weight, but you're producing more power, that's okay. But if you're gaining weight and your power output's going down, something's going on there.
Yeah. I always like looking at kind of momentum, yes, right? So you have your weight and speed. And that is where it's like, look, if you're that much stronger, so if you're playing baseball and you're gaining 15 pounds of muscle, but your bat speed goes down or your elasticity goes down, and you're using that Scandinavian test to kind of show, you know, projection, people are like, well, what does a Scandinavian test have to do with swinging a bat? Well, it's all about hip and power development. Right. Like, you have to think about how all these pieces come together in a symphony of music to create this beautiful orchestra, which is your athlete. Right. And so, like, I think about that stuff all the time, where, you know, every time we have most years outside of the Rona or the Pandy, when we have an actual full-fledged combine and they're always running these 40s, and I'm like, yeah, that's impressive. But a lot of times it's like, well, if that guy's like, you know, 125 pounds, how survivable is he going to be on the NFL football field when everybody's almost as fast as they are, but also 30 or 40 pounds stronger? And so that's the rub, right, if you will, in terms of what we're trying to accomplish with our training. So I love hearing that. Now, do you adhere at all to like a rolling average? So instead of trying to chase a PR, but maybe looking at, hey, like, you know, you had that one day where the girl that you liked in your bio class finally said yes to going to lunch to you. You had sunshine and, you know, you finally slept for 10 hours for one night, you know, and you come out here and you PR. Well, that's great, but now we can't repeat those circumstances. Do you adhere to a rolling average, and how do you monitor that?
Yeah, so we definitely do. So I look at it twofold. I look at a team rolling average on a week-to-week basis.
Awesome.
And I look at an individual rolling average, because now I think if you just – this is for assessment of my program and assessment of what we're doing. If the team is trending in the right direction, then we have a good idea that our training is doing what it's supposed to. I think there's too many individual variants or difference for you to be like, – well, she got faster, she got slower, and now you're just playing kind of a guessing game on the individual. Now, I don't like to look on it on a daily basis for the individual. I like to look over a week. So I'll take their averages over the course of a week, and I'll compare them. So what I do is, so let's say, you know, September 1st, you know, this is our rolling average time, September 8th, and then September 15th. And I'm kind of looking at, well, where are we trending? Are we trending in the wrong direction? Then maybe it's a conversation with the athlete. Maybe they're not sleeping enough. Maybe they're not hydrated. Maybe they're not doing what they have to do off of the field or the court, or maybe not in the weight room as well. So I think it's important to kind of track that data to kind of see where are they trending? Is it just a blip in the radar that they have a strong week and then a down week when then they're back to normal? That's fine. But I like to look at, do we have two or three down weeks in a row? Then we kind of have to reassess what we're doing. And then that's when it becomes a conversation with the sport coach as well. Because let's call it as it is, who are they with the most? They're with their sport coach, right? What are they doing the most of? They're probably practicing more than anything else they do. If I'm lucky on the high end, I'll see a team 4 hours out of a week. Four.
Right.
You know, there's so many other hours in a week. So then it comes to a conversation with the coach, like, what's going on in practice? You know, how are our outputs looking in a game? Because it is pretty – it's kind of scary, but kind of cool to see that when you notice the team average is trending down and then you're not seeing any, the goal production's going down and the run production's going down. Well, maybe there's a red flag that there's something bigger happening. So it is crazy, but you can get a ton of data just by looking at something as simple as a weekly average.
For sure. And there is some things where it's, and I always caution on the opposite end, like, hey, sometimes you're going to have a down week, mm-hmm. but that's going to be a barrier buster for you. But if you're seeing it trending multiple weeks in a row, then we've got serious problems because, you know, we have super compensation that happens day to day, hour to hour, week to week, month to month, all that stuff. And then you see these global improvements. But when you start to see those trends and then you cross-reference it with what's going on in the production on the field, and then you have that conversation with the coach, like, hey, like, you know, this is, we're seeing this in some ways as the strength and conditioning person, you can actually catch it for mm-hmm. them before it becomes a problem in performance, which is makes you even more valuable.
Where, and I think our value is in the object nature of what we do, like saying that someone, oh, I don't know. That's really just your opinion, right? Like, oh, I don't know. Right. They look fast. That's a common one. Oh, they look fast. Oh, okay. Well, what's your data to use that? They look like they're in shape. Okay. Well, what tests are you using to measure that? That's right. Where we come into play and say, no, we actually have a test that it's not my opinion. It's not me guessing. This is exactly what the result is. Like you just said, one time is fine. There could be a lot of things going on. Two, three, four times. Okay, now you have to kind of reassess what you're doing. And again, I think it's crazy. You know, I think for me as a coach, what I used to do, and for any younger coach that hears this, I used to blame myself. Like, oh no, what's mm-hmm. going on? What am I doing? I must be doing something wrong. And then, you know, it's funny when we were doing sprints this past semester, you know, one of our athletes was like, oh man, I only slept 4 hours last night. Okay. Right. So maybe that's why your sprint time isn't good. Maybe it's not me. So I was one that used to take it really personal, like I'm doing something wrong. But at the end of the day, there's so many factors that go into it. You have to consider everything when looking at your program.
Absolutely. So you have a limited amount of time with these athletes, but also I think you had on there 24 different programs that you're in charge of. Is that correct?
Yeah, 21.
So how do you try to keep things efficient for you with the athletes and your communication with the sports coaches? What are some tricks that you found that really work for you to make sure that those 4 hours you get and all those different programs and then all of those different coaches, how do you manage and massage that?
Yeah, so I've been fortunate over the years where we've had assistant coaches that I've been able to bring on, you know, young people in the field that are enthusiastic about it, that, you know, have really helped out with the training, you know, but I oversee it all. But easy part of the communication with the coach is I just share with them a Google Sheet, Google document, and I'm like, hey, listen, it might be tough to talk on a weekly basis, but just check out the sheet. Let me explain to you what each one of these tabs means. And if you ever have a question about it, feel free to reach out. And I also let them know in advance, like, hey, you know, before the season starts, we are in preseason. This is what we're focusing on here. When we get in season, this is what we're doing, you know? So it's almost better to have that initial meeting to kind of discuss what it is that you're doing and then kind of answer whatever questions they have along the way, but at least have that sheet. They can always look at what's going on. Now with regards to the athletes, to me, it's just, well, what is most important to your program? You know, like if I have a team for an hour, well, I'm starting with speed and power because to me, those are the qualities that matter most. And trust me, this is completely different from what I used to do. It used to be, hey, hour in the weight room, what can we do lifting for an hour? You know, let's roll, let's do this, that, and the other. I look back, it was a waste of time. It really was, you know. Now, you know, we do our activation stuff. We go right into sprint mechanics. We get right into our sprint work, whatever the theme is of the day. And then our lift is a total body lift. And we're maximizing every single second they have with me.
Awesome. So when we're talking about the theme of the speed, what are those different themes you like to roll through for your athletes before they then go into the total body lift, whatever you have on the page?
Yeah, so it could be a couple different things. You know, it could be max velocity, like I said, in and out variation, you know, a float, you know, max effort sprint variation, a fly variation. So that kind of is a theme of one day. Another day will just be a straight out max velocity sprint, you know, where we're touching, we're accelerating at a very high manner as well. So whether that's a 30, 40, you know, 50 meter sprint, we'll do that. And then we have an acceleration day where a lot of our sprints will be, you know, maybe up an incline on a hill. It will be some type of resistance, sled, push, pull. And then, you know, we have our tempo day, we have our speed endurance day to kind of touch those qualities that maybe aren't being addressed. That's usually in the off season, usually, you know, with our athletes. If I'm trying to maximize my time, I'm not spending doing a conditioning. I'm doing stuff that's actually going to improve performance and going to improve our ceiling as athletes. To me, they're getting a lot of that throughout their sport itself. So if I only have 2 to 4 hours with an athlete, I'm making sure we maximize it with speed, power, and strength development.
Yeah. And what's really interesting is, so we had my old buddy retired as the football coach at Parkway Central. He has one of the highest winning percentages of any St. Louis area coach that has more than, you know, like three seasons of coaching or whatever. And he's wildly successful, multiple state finals and final fours and all this kind of stuff. And so we have a new coach who's was in the program for a long time. He also had a track and field background himself and got him starting to talk to Brad Dixon and the idea of the feed the cats football mentality and all this kind of stuff. So for the first couple of weeks that they were running, they were just doing some repeat flies, some 20s, some 30s, and then some short yo-yos, not like gassers, not, you know, 400 yard runs around the goalposts or, you know, what you would consider the traditional football, you know, kind of conditioning. And what's amazing is because they were timing them and because they were holding the data and they were posting them, which is that whole rank, mm-hmm. you know, record, publish, or whatever the order is there.
Yeah.
But publish being the last one, they were like falling out. And my new head football coach, he's like, oh my God, are we this out of shape? And of course he came quickly to the realization, oh, it's not this out of shape. It's just, they're really putting out there for that particular test. And you've honored letting them be fresh and time them. So you're even getting this bigger, higher output, which you and I've talked and I've heard you discuss in other conversations, that nothing can measure up to the power output that you have from sprinting. It's like one of the best things you can do.
Nothing can compare. And I think that's where we have to realize that if we're getting so much out of just sprinting, we don't have to hammer away at them even more, because I don't know about my athletes, but for me, like when I do a max effort sprint of, let's say, 40 meters, I'm gassed. I gave everything I have. Now to do that and then be like, okay, you know, we're going to go through an hour lift. Well, it could be damaging to them. But the fact that when you measure and the output is 100% of what they have, to me, there's so much value in that, that to do, you know, anything untimed. And again, you know, coaches, I know they'll be in budgetary restraints and stuff like that, but timing a sprint just makes it so much more valuable. It's actually incredible the results you'll see just from doing that.
Absolutely. And I look at it like going to the restaurant, like, you know, you're going to have your appetizer or whatever you're going to have before the main entree. But either way, you know, when you're sitting down and you're going to have a steak, you know, it's like, well, it's good with this type of wine, or a hamburger is good with this type of, you know, real frothy, creamy type of beer or IPA. And so I always look at the speed and strength as being a symbiotic relationship. So when you have those tests, how do you like to link up your running tests with your full body lift? Like what are your favorite combinations?
It's a loaded question. And because I think it depends on the level of the athlete. So I think when you come to train, and, you know, I train some professional basketball players overseas, you know, for them, it takes a lot to complete an Olympic lift, clean, a jerk, a snatch, because they're moving significant loads. So I usually like to match our max velocity day with those Olympic movements, with our jumps, because I think the theme is the same. Now, if you have a very young athlete that, you know, they can do 4 30-meter sprints and they look fine just because they're, you know, they've never done it before. You know, they don't have that intensity yet that they may, you know, we want them to develop. then to me, they can get into the weight room. They're probably not going to move a huge load. They're probably in the technical aspect of learning all these lifts. Then they can just do a total body lift. But I think when you work with people that have been training for a significant period of time, there's a lot of force and measure that goes into these Olympic movements. I like to pair those with our max effort velocity days. And then on the acceleration, hit some of our other movements like our squats, our deadlifts, our presses and stuff like that. So it depends on the training age of the athlete, but I feel like you just have to be smart in how you're transitioning. And if you notice, hey, we're coming in from a max V day and we squat and they have nothing left, then it's time to reevaluate how you're going about it.
I love that. And then one of the things that I think is really cool is it's like, hey, this is like kind of our, you know, most velocity based training type of activity. This is going to have the most output. This is going to be the most fast or explosive lift. And we're fitting that with the most explosive run. And if we're doing a push day where we're doing acceleration, when we're using those muscle groups, which are different than what we would do in upright running mechanics, well, now we're going to squat or yeah, whatever. And I love how that's paired together. Cause I think again, like a good red wine and a nice bloody steak, you know, they fit together really well. And I think if coaches are thinking about, hey, I've got this limited amount of time, where do I get the most bang for the buck? Those are good options and good templates for other coaches to use. So thank you for that, man.
Yeah. And we did it in season and I loved it, you know, where I don't want them in with me for an hour. It's just, we need to prime them for the game. And especially like sports, like baseball and softball, such a high volume of games. You know, I would see our softball team, you know, we would spend our first day with me hitting some max velocity work, you know, a fly sprint variation. And then we would just do, you know, some type of jerk variation and a clean variation. And then on our second day, you know, maybe after a game where they're a little more fatigued, we would hit some acceleration work, shorter distances, I think less effect on the nervous system as a max V day, and then hit our squatting, our split squat, our bench, our shoulder press, rows, etc. So I think it's important to kind of have the same theme, because if you're doing conflicting things, then you're kind of going to get okay at everything as opposed to really good at one certain quality.
And the thing I think a lot of coaches mess up is when they think recovery, they think complete rest. Right. And the reality is it's like, and Coach Burris a long time ago in the early days of this podcast, you know, the first couple episodes, he talked about, it's not resting is the athlete entirely. Instead, it's like you're resting a system.
Right.
And you're playing with the different biomotor systems and biomotor abilities. And you're playing with that and trying to time it where it makes the most sense. And I love that. It's like, you know, like for us in track, like I've seen coaches, and these are a little bit older school coaches, but you know, some people still make this mistake. They like never really give their kids a day of rest. And what I mean by that is like the days that are typically like rest days would then be like weight room or like highly technical after already doing what I would say is an energy system type of development workout, where there is a little bit more hydrogen ion development, lactate development, whatever, a fatiguing type workout. And I'm like, so when do the athletes ever get to rest? So like for me, when we lift in season, mm-hmm, I always want to pair my lifting in season with what I would consider a very high intensity day, because we only get, you know, usually 2 days, very on rare occasion will we get 3 days in season to do anything in the weight room. Now in the winter, I'm going 4 days a week.
Right.
Why? Because I can guarantee in the weight room, it's 80 degrees and humid in that weight room every freaking day.
Right.
Where you're living out east and I'm living in the Midwest. We get snow, we get bad conditions. You can't guarantee what the weather's going
to
do.
Yeah. And I think it's important to understand how the body responds the day after what you're doing. You know, if it's four straight days and that's currently what we do in our off season, our summer training, you know, it's kind of, we hit that max V the first day because I felt like that's when they were the freshest. And again, I think it takes figuring out your athlete. You know, I've experimented, I've had acceleration that first day, max V the second. I didn't notice great results with some of the kids, so we switched it, got good results. Now they're with me the third straight day. We scale back, we hit some tempo, we work on our rhythm, our mechanics, and then the weight room, it's very isolated circuit. So we might just do body weight stuff, push-ups, single leg squats, stuff like that. And then the following day, we kind of hit another high day. But the reason being is because then they have 3 days of recovery. So you have to map out your plan. And I think it's okay to admit like, oh, that didn't work. that was wrong. Let me readjust. Or that wasn't ideal. Let me readjust. I think as long as you're being objective towards yourself, you can't go wrong. Yeah, we're all going to make mistakes. That's what makes great coaches great. They realize they made a mistake and they change it. So as long as you have a structure to your week and not just burn them out every day and be like, oh, actually, this is going to be recovery day, but we're going to max out our squat. It's like, no,
right.
You got to scale back on everything so then you can have that compensation effect for that next workout.
Absolutely. And that's where I think a lot of coaches mix that up. And because they're not willing, it's the craziest thing to me. I think about like, and I think part of the reason why track and field and strength and conditioning go well together is we're constantly measuring things all the time. We're measuring jumps, we're measuring sprints, we're measuring throws, and you're measuring things, you know, in speed and in power and in strength in the weight room as well. And so that's kind of our business, you know, where if you have a field-based sport sometimes or a team sport coach, they might not know like, hey, like to get what you want on Friday or Saturday, this is kind of the organization that you need to have in your workouts through the week. Not just what we do in our realm in strength and conditioning, but everything else that you're doing, you've got to develop opportunities for rest within that system so that you can get the most out of those kids and they're not just dragging butt at the end of the week.
And I think that's our job as well. It's the education part for the coaches, right? Like we're the experts in this. And we should be educating. So we do something. The NCAA passed catastrophic guidelines for coaches to follow. So one of the things that coaches have to do is they submit weekly practice plans. And, you know, that's not. And so they get submitted to me. I just make sure we're doing everything we're supposed to, you know, nothing that's, you know, ridiculously out of place, you know, like extra conditioning for no reason, stuff like that. But it helps because to me, we can look at the practice plan together and be like, well, let's talk about why do you think this is good 2 days before? Why do you do this a day before? And it just gives them some more information. Because again, they're experts on the sport. We're experts on how the body's responding to everything. So, and how we're supposed to train the body in the right way to prepare them for game day. So I feel like it's our job as professionals to also educate the coaches, because that's why we're all a big team. We're helping the coaches to succeed. So I feel like it's also our job to help educate them on the physical demands of the body.
For sure. And you mentioned, a while back about having the kind of that big conversation at the beginning of the season, right? Is that what you kind of discussed?
Yes,
your
absolutely.
Kind of plan?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I, if I had to guess and tell me if I'm wrong, part of that is they're probably going to be more receptive to it, more open to it, more understanding than when you get in the heat of games and competitions, those conversations become a little bit harder to come by as you get into the heat of the main competition phase.
Absolutely. And that's the beautiful thing about recording data. Data doesn't lie. So you can tell me that, hey, you know, we're in bad shape or this, that, and the other. And I'm like, well, that's weird because as a team, we've improved our speed by, you know, 1 mile per hour. So I wouldn't say they're in bad shape, you know, or hey, our power output's way up. Our jumping average went up 2 inches as a team. Well, we're definitely not lacking in the power department. Maybe it's something else, because I think the problem is technical or tactical execution usually gets then addressed as we're in bad shape. It's like, right. No. There are many factors. And just as I would never say this is responsible for getting faster, I would never say this is why we lost in the fourth quarter, because it's impossible to say. There's too many factors that go into it for you to just pinpoint one thing. So I think it's good to address it in the beginning when everyone is kind of fresh in their mindset. Once you get into the middle of it and you're on the brink of, you know, playoffs and stuff like that, for you to start addressing these issues, it might be a tougher conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And like in the classroom, my philosophy has been forever, come in like a lion, leave like a lamb, you know, so that way they know this is the boundaries. I'm the one telling the jokes. I'm the one for the tax paid dollars telling the stories. You are not, you know, I am the sage on the stage, not the guide on the side most of the time. Right. And I'm certainly the sage on the stage at the beginning more than I am at the end. You know, and there's evolutions and how things can come on responsibility wise. And, you know, like you look at like American football, and one of the things they always say in American football is like, oh, you know, the defense is always ready to go right before the offense. Well, it's not like the defense is in better shape. Literally their responsibilities and the complexity of what they have to do to stop a play. And I know some defensive coaches listen to this and be like, that's not true. You know, I run 7 different fronts and I do all sorts of stunting. Yeah. But the reality is that the offense always tends to be especially an offense that isn't running based, tends to be a little bit slower on the, you know, on the come up because of what you just said, the technical execution and all those things. And when things change in the season, it might be because either you're playing tougher opponents who are just as physically fit and powerfully built and explosive as you are, or they've started to scout you and you don't have enough flexibility in your program, or you're not scouting them enough to figure out how to divide and conquer whatever they're trying to do against you.
Yeah. And so I think saying the easiest thing is we're not in shape. That's why we lost. I think it's the easiest thing. I think it's the most misdirected towards why we're losing. You don't lose games because of that. You really don't. Like, usually you're losing because the other team outplayed you. And that's the most simple matter. Now, like I said, if you're not measuring things, you have no way to know if that's true. But if you're constantly measuring stuff, and maybe you have the luxury of GPS units as well, and you could track, you know, fatigue levels, then that's a different story. But usually that's a very misguided thing to be like, we're out of shape, that's why we lost. You're not giving any fairness to the other team as well. Maybe they just played a really good game and beat you. And that's okay. It's okay to not have a good game. But to always just think that conditioning is the answer, I really don't feel like that's where you should go as your first reason as to why you lose a game.
I agree 100%. And I think the other thing could be looked at is something you mentioned earlier too. It's like, all right, so like, here are our numbers. Our numbers look great. Our percentages look great. Maybe they do look fatigued or tired on game day. But what's your warm-up look like? What's your night before? What's your shoot around look like? What does your walkthrough look like? Is it not really a walkthrough? Is it something else? Or, hey, is this the first time you've done a tournament? Yeah. Or is this the first time that you've gone out of town and traveled? You know, these are all sorts of things that need to be considered. And it's better, just like we talked about, address those things up front. Call them out as potential pitfalls. So like in my track program, I tell the ladies, like, look, you're probably not going to sleep real well the day before districts or sectionals or state, because those meets matter. Mm-hmm. And you got to qualify out of them to get to the next level. There's a level of extra energy that's there. I don't want you to treat those competitions as anything else but a business trip. And we're here to do our business. You don't need to do anything radically different. However, the reality is you're probably not going to sleep that well. Right. So then because of that, then Thursday night, you got to make sure you're getting to bed, because it'll be easier, literally easier for you to fall asleep on Thursday night than it will be Friday night the day before. So make sure you're being disciplined on Thursday. Not that I don't want you to be disciplined on Friday, but let's make sure we don't have 2 days in a row of screwing up.
Yeah.
And we can perform.
Yeah. And that's where the mental aspect really comes in. And I know we had some competition in the spring, and this was for our fall sports, so they didn't play this year. And we, you know, for our teams, we were getting in much better shape, quote unquote. You know, we were getting faster, we were getting stronger, and they played in a game, and they were like, we were gassed within 15 minutes. And I'm like, okay, well, let's look at it this way. It's not a physical issue, because I see all these improvements in you guys, but this was your first game in God knows how long, right? How were you juiced up? Were you too excited? Were you over anxious? All those factors contribute. So just like you said, I think it's good to address before you get there, so then you can prepare. Because to me as a player, I was that way too. I was so juiced up that by the time the game started, I was fatigued and I didn't even do anything. You know, so that just shows you how big the mental aspect is in preparing you to play. But I agree with you 100%. You see these warm-ups, teams are out there for an hour before they play. It's like, well, what do you expect to happen? You're not warming up. You just did a full-blown activity, you know? So all of those things factor in, but it's always good to plan that out, so then you can kind of make changes where need be based on how the season's progressing.
Totally. And the thing that, like, I look at, and this is for sport coaches in general, like, there would be games where maybe I wouldn't get any playing time and I was still sore. That shouldn't happen. Right. So that says, then what the hell are we doing in the warm-up that is so radically different than what we do either throughout the week or competition? Like, one of the things that drives me nuts, and I've had to mentor some of my colleagues and some of my friends, it's like, hey, like, we want to have a competition warm-up, but the competition warm-up should include elements of things that we are doing in practice on a regular basis. It shouldn't all of a sudden be like, well, we're going to do some like weird walking alligator crawls when we never alligator crawl. And then what does that have to do with cross country or track and field? We're not running through wires and doing tough mutters. Like, everything we should do should be to prepare for that particular competition. And I feel like, again, strength and conditioning coaches have the opportunity to guide the sports coaches through that. Like, hey, like, this is a missing element in your warmup. This is a missing element in your preparation.
Well, that's why I think the dynamic, what you see most times is nothing, is far from dynamic. You know, it's walking movements, it's pulling on different parts of your body to prepare you before you actually get into the part that matters. And then you're almost warming up doing that. So why right. even waste time? Get right into what's actually going to matter. And that's why I used to do that, right? And I, like I said, I'm able to judge that now because I did it myself and I realized how bad it was. Like, doing a lateral lunge versus doing, you know, a speed bound is completely different, right? Like, right. a lateral lunge probably isn't going to prepare you to play. At least that speed bound, that straight leg bound is preparing you for the demands of what you're going to go through. And to be honest, you're no longer wasting time in your preparation drills. Now you're full go into that drill as opposed to doing it for 20 minutes pregame. Maybe you could do it for 10 and save that extra right. 10 minutes of energy for the things that matter, which is the competition.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are the things that I just think, like, again, strength and conditioning coaches in a nice partnership with the field-based sports or the sports coaches can really help clean a lot of that stuff up and make sure that that happens. Cause I mean, it used to drive me nuts. I'm like, I didn't play and I feel like crap. Something's not right here. You know? And yeah, you've got, like you said, the nervous energy and all that stuff. But one of the things I think also that strength and conditioning coaches can do is kind of help the athletes get through some of those things, the 21 hours that they're away from their sport or they're away from you. Like, hey, if sleep matters and these athletes look fatigued and that's the reason why they're not sleeping, but their performance numbers are great. Okay. Now we got to target sleep.
Yes.
Like, what's good sleep hygiene, right? So are there any things that you found that are some of those kind of like low hanging fruit that are also that you might grab that might be out of the weight room, things the kids can do at home that you found to be really useful?
Yeah, just breathing exercises. I think to me, those are just the foundation, right? Like, that's the thing we do most throughout the entire day. We should be learning how to breathe the correct way. So I like at the end of our workouts, especially in season, to just lay down and breathe. And I'll just take the athletes through some mindful breathing, you know, different inhalation, exhalation patterns, stuff like that. I think that's number one. Like, you have to learn how to breathe correctly. Every single athlete that I've ever known, ever since I learned about, you know, reflexive performance reset and RPR, anyone who's ever had any tweak or injury and I get them to lay down and I'm like, just let me see you breathe. It's always wrong. It's all through the chest, you know, nothing through their belly. To me, they're just in a heightened state. Their sympathetic nervous system's through the roof. They don't know how to breathe the correct way. And I think it's taken for granted, right? It may sound ridiculous, but we have to be taught how to breathe the correct way. So I think that's number one. And the nutrition to me is just another low-hanging fruit. You know, we're lucky enough where we have a refueling station where the athletes can grab protein shakes, bars, carbohydrates, supplementation, stuff like that. If your nutrition's not taken care of, you're seriously limiting your genetic potential. And I think it's one of those factors that matters the most that a lot of coaches don't talk about. And I don't know if it's because they're uncomfortable or they're not really sure what to say, but just basic nutritional information goes a long way in the development of the athlete and the recovery of the athlete, which I think is particularly important after a competition. So those factors and hydration, those are the three big ones that I focus on: sleep, you know, breathing, nutrition, and hydration. You have to check all those boxes if you want to perform at an elite level or maximize your genetic potential.
Yeah. And it's funny because people think like, oh, you know, I need this many square meals a day, or I need to get more of this in my diet. Like, it's interesting, like at home, certain family members in my family have lost weight since coronavirus. And some of my family members have gained weight based on our diet. You know, like, we're eating more at home. And, you know, so things are better when we're not eating French fries every day. We're eating steak, we're eating chicken, we're eating big pieces of meat. Well, that might not be as good for the poundage for another person in the family,
right?
You know, and it's interesting. Or like, hey, I'm a super absorber of B12. How do I know that? I went and got my genetic testing. Not every college kid or high school kid probably can do that, or maybe even should do that. But, you know, there's so many, like you said, so many obvious flaws in people's basic, you know, nutrition, hydration, sleep and even breathing, the things that we do all the time in order to survive. And we don't think about them very often, which is like crazy
And they just try, you can't copy someone else's patterns. And I think that's the biggest thing. You try to be like, oh, well, what's so-and-so eating? And I'm like, let's slow down here. Let's just focus on you, because you're a unique individual. Like you said, you absorb B12 at a high level. Okay, someone else may not. So for you to copy their diet, or for them to copy you, that could be very misguided. So I always say, let's focus on you. Let's kind of write down what it is that we're doing on a daily basis. Then we can start to say, hey, we can make improvements here. You know, we do a great job here, because you're an individual. Your body is unique like any other. It's not like any other person out there. So for you to copy another person's diet, hydration patterns, whatever it is, you're doing yourself a disservice, because not everyone is made the same.
Yeah, for sure. And then when we think about, like, you know, breathing, it is really interesting, because like, we had a young lady in cross country, and we're like, man, why are you getting so tired all the time? And we're like, you know, as she's running, she's like, oh, you know, I just feel this. So I'm like, all right, we got to spend some time watching her. She didn't open her mouth. I'm like, you don't have your mouth open. You're running 5,000 meters. And yeah, we want you to breathe through the nose and exhale out through the mouth, and, you know, really have that deep belly push, right? Or maybe count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, you know, and, you know, all sorts of different breathing techniques. But literally, kiddo, you didn't have your mouth open. And it's like, you would think that most people would think in a event where, you know, you are getting an increasing load and increasing fatigue, that, you know, the mouth is going to have to be open. You're going to have to take more air. Or we talk about simple, you know, breathing patterns while racing. Like, these kids would get really short of breath and they'd get in panic.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, how many strides are you taking between each breath? They're like, I don't know. And I'm like, well, that's a problem. Like, you know, if you're running at a cruise pace, it should probably be somewhere around three steps, breathe out, three steps, breathe in. You know, and then if you're kicking it in at the end, or you're picking up the pace or surging, it's probably going to be 2 and 2, you know, and it's like, you know, two steps and out, two steps in, you know, and that's fine too.
Right.
You know, but you've got to figure out that pattern. And if you're not thinking about it, like, it's a real problem. You're just out there panicking, you know, and getting an oxygen debt. It's insane.
And you can never, as a coach, you just can't make an assumption that it's just common knowledge. It's just not for a lot of these athletes, and it's not their fault. They just don't know. But that's why we're in the positions we are, to teach them about breathing the correct way, breathing during stride patterns, because they don't know. Odds are they're just going out and doing whatever their body naturally does. So it's up to us to educate them and inform them, and then it's on them to implement it. And I can't stress that enough. I think that people always want to say, well, what am I doing wrong that it's not working? At the end of the day, it's on the athlete to implement this on themselves. So I can tell you to do everything under the sun that's correct. If you don't do it at a high level of what I'm asking you, you're going to be limited in your success. So you can only lead a horse to water, but at the end of the day, they got to be the ones to take that next step in optimizing performance.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things where it's like, hey, you know, we don't want you to blindly buy in or trust the process, but I'm giving you a lot of reasons why you should trust the process, right? Like, here's the data, here's the rationale for what we're doing. I don't want to give you a biology lesson, but here are some simple concepts that you do need to kind of do these things, or, you know, you're just going to fail to maximize your human potential over and over and over again. I tell my athletes all the time, coach, I'm like, we can make you good,
right,
but you decide whether you're going to be great.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's really up to them. All right. So a few more questions, if you got time for
me.
All right. So you got to start a program from the ground up, learning through that experience. Couple different questions within this. All right. Number one, what would you do all over again? And you found to be very valuable. Okay. And what was some hard lessons that you learned that needed to change as you evolve through this process with these two freaking dozen teams that you are responsible for?
Yeah. So what I would do again, I, hold everyone to the same standard. I think there's a tremendous amount of valuable there, holding people accountable. I think that helps you grow your program to where you want it to be. Yes, there are a lot of things you can let slip through the cracks, because at the end of the day, it's tiring to constantly fix people to get it done the way you want it to be done. But, and to be honest, and this is dead wrong, but I used to spend 12, 14-hour days at my job making sure it was done exactly the way I want it. So this is probably a hard lesson. You have to delegate. You have to delegate responsibility. I think it is such a horrible trend we have gotten in the field of strength and conditioning that you must sacrifice. And I hate work-life balance. I hate it. You live, your life is the most important thing. Your family is the most important thing. Why do we have to find a way to balance that? You should be doing your job because you love it, right? Like everything I do, I'm a father first. I'm a husband first. My job is what I do because I love it. It shouldn't be the opposite way around. And I think that was the lesson I learned. And I'm glad I figured it out in a short period of time that this is not number one in my life. My number one is my family, my religion, my relationship with God. That's one. This is what I do because I love it and I want to help people. So that was definitely a hard lesson that I would never do again. I think our field is completely broken for that. I know people that work 60 to 80 hour weeks. They're not compensated the right way for it. Their health takes a hit. It's wrong. It's wrong. And as a field, it's almost like people that are older is almost like it's expected. And I thought it was expected of me as well. I couldn't be further. I was so dead wrong. It is something I tell all the coaches that I work with. Stop working these crazy hours. Stop waking up at 4 a.m. for a 5 a.m. workout, because that's what they're asking of you. Because at the end of the day, if you left this job, they're replacing you a week later, whether you like it or not. It's the cold, hard truth. Would people be sad? Yes. Will they find someone to take it? Absolutely. So that was definitely a hard lesson I learned. But in terms of, you know, holding everyone accountable, you know, doing things the exact way you want it done, I would do that all over again. It's a lot of work to, hey, behind the line, hey, wear the same clothes, tuck your shirt in, no earrings, this, that, and the other. But to me, you just set up the accountability, you develop that camaraderie with the teams training together, and we're able to get where we're at, and I'm pretty happy. We have a lot of room to grow and develop, but I would say just holding everyone accountable to the highest level is something I would do over and over again, because I think it's gotten to where we're at today.
Yeah, that accountability piece is really, really important. And so like with my teams and my classroom and everything else, when we sit down at the beginning, I'm like, here are my expectations. Here are my expectations within practice. This is how we're successful. You know, if you can't buy in, then I send it to the parents, you know, and I have my overarching theme, do the right thing in the right way at the right time, you know, and I was pretty good at that. Now, figuring out how to live that and get that done a little bit, there's a process there without a doubt. And, you know, I've had that situation too. When you finally have kids, it also makes you reevaluate, like, what am I spending all this time on? Like, how much is this really worth in terms of my output and performance? Or am I actually being lazy by being here this long, which is a real opposite thought. People are like, wait a second, you're there all the time, you know, then, you know, you're really putting in a lot of effort. Yeah. Or I could be wasting a lot of time because I am unwilling to do some of the other things, like you said, whether it's delegate authority or create avenues for me to get this stuff done in a different way. And maybe it's more digital based, or maybe it's something I'm uncomfortable with that because it's a new piece of technology. Or like, hey, I don't trust this coach. Well, I need to trust them. They're one of my employees. Yeah. They're in my program. So if I don't trust them, then how can I learn to trust them? Okay, right. Well, then I've got to stair-step responsibilities. I've got to create avenues for them to grow into the position, you know, those type of things.
Yeah, because what you just said, are you there for the hours you are to actually accomplish something, or are you just doing it to do it? And that's what I was doing. My workout, I'm not kidding you, on my Mondays, my first couple of years there, I started at 6 a.m. and I went to 7 p.m. There wasn't a break in that day whatsoever. One of the stupidest schedules I've ever made. And at the end of the day, do you think I have the same energy for the 6 p.m. group as I do the 7 a.m. group? Because the answer is no. And if coach says they do, then they're just lying to you and not being truthful. You don't have to be there for everything. You have to learn how to let go and have other people do jobs for you at a high level. So that way your department can grow. Because if you try to do it yourself, you're going to fail. And I know for me personally, I was that person. I hated to wait. I hated to go to bed Sunday because I knew the week was ahead of me. And I'm like, this is going to be a bad week because I have 60 hours to take care of at my job. So to me, that was the biggest lesson I tell every coach I come across. Don't kill yourself because it's really just not worth it. One more thing on the hard lesson part. Not everyone's going to like you and your program.
Right.
And that is absolutely fine. If you work with a 400 athletes, not everyone's going to like you. And it doesn't matter who you are. You could be a saint. You can explain everything. And someone's going to say they know better than you. Their trainer is better than you. That's okay. You're there to influence the people that are going to buy into what you say. You're there to help the kids that are appreciate you. And I used to take everything to heart. Why don't they like the workout? Why are they not giving a good effort? It's okay. That's on them. I did my career. My career is over. My career is in helping people now. I can only help you if you want to be helped. And if you don't trust me or if you don't believe me after I explain everything to you, I will meet with you one-on-one. Just like you said, I'm not going to give you a biology lesson, but if you want me to give you chalk talk on why we're doing this, I'll spend 8 hours talking to you about it. But at the end of the day, not everyone's going to be okay with it. And that's just fine. It's okay. You just have to let that go. Do your best on a daily basis. And that's all you can ever ask of yourself.
Yeah, for sure. And with that too, I think comes some experience oftentimes and some reflection. Cause like, you know, as a coach or strength and conditioning coach and stuff, you almost feel like you have these like not as intimate relationships in a romantic sense, but you have a lot of these intimate relationships because you're spending so much time with these people. And this is an important part of their life. You know, yeah. It's a critical moment of their life. They will hang on to some of these things for the rest of their life. And what's interesting is it in my mind, it is about intent. So like my friend told me a long time ago, he's like, man, you know, if you pulled out a gun and you pulled the trigger and it were at point blank range and the gun misfired, you're still a murderer.
Yeah.
And I said, man, that's some powerful and some dark stuff. Yeah. I said, that's dark. But I thought a lot about it. And I said, but you know what? The opposite is true as well. If I intended to help and my intentions were noble, and as coaches, we have to understand that, like, oh my God, things are not going to go the way you want them to. Mm-hmm. You're going to fail. There's going to be mistakes. And what stinks is that sometimes our mistakes interrupt a human's happiness or performance or success, but that's the way it goes. Just like their mistake on a sport field causes their sport coach grief and stress and everything else. We all affect each other in this kind of puzzle that's always shifting its pieces, but it's the same pieces that are out there. And we're constantly trying to make the picture better and better as we move together in our little cultures and societies that we're a part of, team being one, family being one, friends being another, right? And so like, if my intentions are good and my intentions are purposeful, doesn't mean, hey, I still have to own up for a mistake with a positive intention. Don't hold on to it with guilt and letting it lag, because like every time a girl that's really talented in my program quits my team, you know, or whatever, I'm like, gosh, man, that sucks. Why don't they like that? Well, it's like, you know, what about your sport? You know, it's track and field. You could be the most charismatic individual in the world, and some people just don't like to throw, run, and jump. You know, it's just the reality. So that's a really powerful thing for the viewers or the listeners to hear from you, because that is some really, really good truth. All right. Last question for you, coach.
Yeah.
So in terms of when you talk about your influences and your growth, and I feel like you're a growth mindset coach, who, when you're looking into the future for people that you would like to interact with, people you haven't met yet, but are going to come into your life, what qualities do you want those people to have when they come into your life and influence your process? What do you want them to have?
So the influence I want to have on people, or they have on me?
The influence actually that they have on you.
The influence I want them is to challenge me. I want to be challenged, just like you said, growth mindset, not only as a professional, but as a person. And just like I just learned that from you right now, the intent piece, like that is something that I'm going to take with the rest of my life. So from people that I'm going to experience in my life. I want to be challenged in all aspects of my life. How can I be a better coach? How can I be a better father, a better husband, a better Catholic? I want to be challenged in that area. And I want to be told things that I don't like, because I think at the end of the day, it's good to hear stuff that you don't necessarily agree with, because I think it's a powerful thing to absorb stuff that you don't really naturally think about and then be like, you might have a point there. You know, because I think it's so powerful when you open up your mind and just admit, I don't know everything, number one, and I can be better, number two. And my life is all about growth in so many different areas that if I'm not learning, or if I'm like, you don't know better than me, I've been doing this longer, that's when you stop growing as an individual. And so anyone I come across in my life, I just want to be challenged mentally, you know, intellectually, and just how can I be better? That's what I hope to accomplish. Anyone I come across from and realize, man, there's so much more to learn, and there's so much more out of life that I'm not there yet.
Awesome, Coach. Well, how can people get a hold of you or reach out to you or connect with you? What are the avenues for them to make that connection?
Yeah. They can reach out to me. They can email me. They can email me at kferrara@adelphi.edu. They can just follow. They can follow me on Twitter, BigK28. They can shoot me a message there. Really, any way, you know, find a way to get in contact with me. I love talking to everyone. I've met so many people during this time. It's been absolutely incredible. So anytime anyone reaches out to me, I want to get back. I want to connect and help out in any way possible.
Awesome, Coach Ferrara. We're really happy to have you on here. And thank you for giving us so much time and so much value in the discussion today. I know a lot of our listeners are going to get a lot out of this. And to our listeners, remember, we need you guys to share this out, subscribe, give us a review, put comments where you can put comments. Let us know how we're doing. And most importantly, be smart, be safe, make good decisions. Peace out.